When I was in college, I took Psychology 101 from one of the probably most famous professors at my school. His name was Philip Zimbardo. Anybody recognize that name? Yeah, Phil Zimbardo. So he's this like old school psychology guy. He ran this crazy experiment where he like turned a bunch of students into psychopaths, basically. Alice knows about it, apparently. So you can... What's that?
That was you?
That was Philip Zimbardo. You know, that was not me. I was not one of the students turning into psychopaths. That was like in the 70s or 80s, 60s. It was a long time ago. Anyway, so he's kind of a big name in psychology. So I took his Psych 101 class. And this class was like, we called it the Zimbocentric class, because we had Philip Zimbardo as the professor of our class, so all the lectures were given by him. He wrote the textbook that we used, and so we read his textbook. We had to read a chapter, I think, every class period. And he also had done this like PBS-type video series on psychology that we had to watch every week. And so like everything was about Zimbardo. The lectures, the book, the videos, and he had a little bit of an ego, you might say. But it was like you just heard his voice everywhere, no matter where you went in this class. Everything was about him. Well, tonight we're looking at this passage in Colossians, where everything, again, is about one person. And yet the picture tonight that Colossians presents is more accurate about who it should be about. We see this passage about Christ. A lot of people think this passage may have been an early hymn because it's so poetic, because there's so much repetition and so much kind of poetic elements in it. And this passage really, as I said in my email, is one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible because there's so much packed into these words. It's so dense. It's so rich. And I think it does an amazing job of helping us to see that Christ is really at the center, not just of Thursday nights or Sunday mornings or prayer or Bible study, but Christ is really at the center of everything we experience. And even more surprisingly, Christ is the center of everything everybody else, everybody experiences. I don't think we realize how central Jesus is to the whole world. That's what we're going to see tonight. If you remember from last week, Colossians is a book written by the Apostle Paul. Relatively minor city. Paul writes to them. They're in a pretty good place. They're not at risk of major heresy. They're not falling apart. They're not traipsing off into crazy sin. They're pretty healthy, but they have this issue, this cultural pressure that threatens to draw them away, that threatens to pull them into some false teaching. And so Paul writes to ground them, to recenter them on the truth of the gospel, on the heart of the gospel. And I suggested last week that it's a good book for us to do the same thing with, that we are, for the most part, a community of pretty healthy faith, and yet we live in a culture where we're constantly bombarded with crazy ideas about the way the world works, about what Christianity might be, about what the best way to live our lives is. And so this is a helpful book for us to just recenter on Christ and understand what it looks like to be a Christian and have Christ at our center. Passage tonight is actually, in one sense, it's a presentation of the gospel. What we looked at last week is how the gospel is for the Colossians and needs to be for us the heart of what we believe, that we always come back to it. There is no Christianity 2.0. There's no next level. The gospel is always the core of our faith. And in some ways, this passage is a presentation of the gospel, but it's different from the gospel presentations that we might think of. Most of the gospel presentations that we think of, or when we think about what the gospel means to us, it begins with us, right? The classic one that Campus Crusade developed begins with, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. The gospel starts with you, because when we're honest, like, that's what we care about, right? I care about me and what happens to me and my life. So if I'm going to appeal to you, I'll start with you, because that's what's going to draw you in. The cool thing about this presentation, though, is it doesn't do that. It doesn't start with us. We're included in it, but we're like the step three of the process. This presentation of the gospel begins with Acer computers. That's a nice screensaver. It begins with Christ over creation, and it begins with the world that we know of. And then it moves into the church and what Christ has done in the church. And then it moves to us to help us understand how we fit in there. So let's start. I'm going to read Colossians 1:15-17. Where's the little clicker? Can I use it?
Awesome.
All right, so here's Colossians 1. Maybe somebody would read that aloud for us. Volunteer?
Thanks. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together.
All right, as I said, this is a really dense, rich passage. Let's see if we could unpack some of it. Starts off by saying he is the image of the invisible God. Now, this is a bit of an oxymoron, right? If God is invisible, if God can't be seen, how can he have an image? So this is speaking of Christ as something that makes known what is otherwise invisible, abstract, in some ways unknowable. God can't be seen. And this word image is actually the Greek word icon, which is fairly similar to the word that we use called icon. So I thought we'd have a little quiz. This is an easy quiz, all right? Name these icons. Ready for this? It's challenging. Nice. You guys can be louder than that. Come on, okay. Next one.
Amazon.
Amazon, right.
Skype. Wikipedia. Dropbox.
Flipboard.
Nice, that was a little bit trickier. Yeah, Flickr. See, Adrian's old school, he knows Flickr. Flickr's kind of passe now. So icons are interesting. Let's think about one of these icons. Think about the Facebook icon, right? I mean, Facebook is, for a lot of us, part of our lives. We use it for certain things. It has certain associations. And this image, this icon, encapsulates that somehow, right? And we see this thing, and that is, in a sense, Facebook. But what is Facebook? There isn't anything, right? I mean, it's a company, it's an organization, it's a website, but Facebook is this thing, it's this entity, it's something that occupies some portion of our lives. It helps us, it's a tool, it's a site. And this icon kind of like draws all that together, right? Everything that it is, it like encapsulates it in this little bunch of pixels. So that when we see it, we associate all of that stuff. And that's pretty similar to what Paul is saying Jesus does here. He says he is the image of the invisible God. That when you see Jesus, when Jesus became flesh and walked on the earth, and even now, Jesus draws out all of those aspects of God. Everything that he is encapsulated in this person, his character, his identity, his nature. All of God is seen in Jesus. Then he says that he's the firstborn of all creation. This one is a tricky one because some people actually read this, and early church heresy started from this verse, that believed that Jesus was born, that Jesus was actually created. Because this verse can seem to imply that Jesus was born first of all the things in creation. Now, that's not what this means. The word here is prototokos, which is another Greek word. Basically means the first in the sense of priority, the first in sense of importance, of supremacy. He is the leader. He is the initiator. He is the founder. He is the one that started. And so Jesus is the first in importance among all of creation. He is the leader. He is at the top. And then he goes on and he talks about how things were created. And this is something that I think isn't always obvious to us, that Jesus had an integral role in the creation of everything we know. We think of Jesus as walking the earth. We think of him as dying on the cross. We think of him as saving us from our sins. But the fact that Jesus was there at creation, that he was involved in it, is something we don't often realize. Starts off by saying he was there, he created heavens and the earth. For the first century worldview, heavens would be speaking of the skies. So Jesus created the stars. He created space itself. He created everything we know that we're familiar with on Earth and everything that's out there. Have you guys read, there's recently this new Big Bang discovery. Have you seen this in the news? So I'm probably going to get all the physics wrong. But as I understand it, they've discovered evidence that in the first, like, not even millisecond, but like millisecond of the universe, that the universe expanded really quickly, faster than the speed of light, and that gives new credence to the idea that all of creation began in one moment from the Big Bang. If that's true, and who knows whether it's true, Jesus did that. That process, whatever happened in that moment, in that hair of a moment, was the work of Jesus. That's what this verse is saying. I like to read XKCD. So here's a XKCD comment. It says, just think, the light from that star was emitted thousands of years ago. It could be long gone. Or the person says, that's serious. It's 8 light years away. Oh. Just think, the light from that star was emitted in the previous presidential administration. That doesn't quite pack the same punch. So I actually read this comic, and I didn't realize this. So I had to like look up, are stars really that close? And it's true. I always thought all the stars, you're like millions of years old. But yes, it's true. So 8 years ago, some of these stars are presented. But again, that means these stars, the light we see, everything out there, all of it was Jesus. He had a hand in creating all of this stuff. Paul goes on to say that that Jesus had a role in creating everything visible and invisible. This is, of course, what we see and what we don't see. I think our first inclination when we hear this is to think of invisible as spiritual elements. And I'm not sure that's exactly what's intended. I think it's all the forces that we're aware of, both physical forces and bodies, but also emotions and thoughts and attitudes and influences that are there, that are real, that can't be argued with, but we don't perceive. All of that, all of our capability to feel and to think, all of that goes back to Jesus. And he talks about thrones, dominions, rulers, or authorities. And these are basically the factors external to yourself that affect you. So who are the people that have the biggest influence on your day? They can affect your mood the most. Who are they?
Students.
Your students.
Coworkers.
Roommates.
Parents.
Your boss.
Significant other. What's that? Peers?
Commuters,
right. Exactly. Yeah. So all of these people, I think, in some way or another, have some level of authority over you. Even people that you might have authority over, like students, in some way, they affect you because they exert control over you, right? Other commuters affect you because they exert control over what you can do or can't do. And so I think what Paul's getting at here is all of those factors, all of those forces. And we might paraphrase this list of four things as titles. Thrones are the positions of power. Dominions are the realms of power. So that might be our companies or our states or our communities. Rulers were people that were in positions of power. So that might be our bosses or our parents or people that are over us in some way. And authorities are all of those people that might not be above us, but might have some influence on us. So these would be influences on us. So titles, companies, bosses, influences, all of those things that affect us, Jesus created them. He created those titles, those positions. He created those people. He put them there. So everything that changes, whether I'm in a good mood or a bad mood, or whether I get a raise or don't get a raise, or whether my parents allow me to do something or don't, all of those things, Jesus is at the core of. Jesus affects those. And then this is really cool. We skipped over the first one, but Paul has three prepositions that he uses to describe the relationship between creation and Jesus. He says that the creation happened by him, through him, and for him. That Jesus, that the world was created by Jesus, through Jesus, and for Jesus. And if we think about those three ideas, it really covers the whole gamut of how you might interact with something. I thought maybe the best analogy, how many of you like Legos or liked Legos? You don't have to admit if you still play with them. We'll confess that in secret. But if you imagine a little boy with one of those, you know, those like green sheets that you build on, right? You start with that and you build your Legos and you build your world and you have a house or you have a knight and a castle or whatever it is, and you create this entire entity that was created by this little boy, right? He was the one that did it. The word here that's through him, the idea here is agency. Who caused it to happen? Who affected it? And again, that little boy is the one whose agency, whose creativity came up with this whole thing. It was all in his head. And so it was his agency that got it from his head. He had the vision for this little Lego world. So it was through him that this was made. And then, why was it made? Why did the little boy do this? Because it's fun, right? Because this is entertaining. Because it brings him pleasure to make this Lego world. And so, if you think about a little boy or a little girl playing with Legos, it's made by him or her, through him or her, for him or her. And that's what the idea here is that Jesus is. That everything we see, heavens, earth, powers, invisible, visible, all of that Jesus caused to happen. All of it was his agency, was his vision, was his design for life to be this way. And all of it happened for his sake. That in some way that I think is way too mysterious for us to understand, Jesus derives pleasure from the creation. He created it so that he might be, so that he might enjoy it. And I think we kind of get that. I mean, there's fulfillment. There's some level of connection when you create something, when you have a vision and see it played out into reality. So all of creation, the very lives that we live, was done for that. And lastly, this is one of my favorite phrases. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. In Jesus, all things hold together. Does anybody actually like study physics here? Okay, so maybe you can close your ears because I'll probably destroy your field now. So this is where I really don't understand what I'm talking about. But I understand that something holds stuff together. Am I okay so far? There is some force that holds everything together. So I was trying to read an article on this so I could sound smart, but if you think about what a stuff made of, right? Let's take this, my pen, okay? What is this made of? Plastic. Okay, what's the plastic made of?
Molecules.
Molecules. What are the molecules made of?
Atoms.
Atoms. What are the atoms made of?
Subatomic
particles. What are they called?
Quarks.
What else? What are the... Wait, are we still good? Quarks? Yeah. So you have, like, this is pretty solid, right? There's stuff here. But what the physicist tells us, or at least the article I read, say that there's actually not a whole lot of stuff in this pen. That there's molecules and atoms and, where are we? Protons. Hey, you forgot protons. Protons and electrons and quarks. But the actual, like, mass, the actual thing that makes this up is actually very, 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 very small, right? But there's these things that hold it together. So there's a world, I'm guessing this is actually a real word. I didn't get this article like off the Onion or something, but gluons, right? These are real things. And this is like attractive forces that hold all these little things of stuff together to make stuff. And it's like weird. We don't even understand it. But I think what this is saying is that in some way, the forces that make this plastic, that hold the quarks together so that they form larger elements, and in some way that is Jesus. That Christ holds all things together. That he literally is responsible for matter not just crumbling, disintegrating, flying apart into nothingness. I think it's actually pretty interesting that it would be phrased this way in an age, in a culture where there was no understanding of molecules and atoms and quarks and gluons and whatever else there is there. So somehow Jesus is holding this world together, that without him, it would all literally fall apart. Logging off. Uh-oh. Shutting down. We have just fallen apart without Jesus. That's okay. So, oh no, really, Windows? That's okay. We'll see how long my sermon lasts. See if I can finish before 100%. So the question then is, if this is true of Jesus, if Jesus is really like bigger than this, if he's really at the center of everything, what do we do with that? What does that mean? How do we process that? And the simplest answer is simply we worship. I mean, that's what we do. That's the only possible response to an idea this large, of this magnitude, that we simply have to fall down and say, I don't deserve to be in his presence. He's so much bigger, so much greater, so much at the center of everything. And we just worship. We just say, glory to you, God. And in particular here, what this passage starts with is worshiping Christ as the Creator. Worshiping Christ as the Creator. This presentation starts with creation because creation has to be, if we're assembling the building blocks of what it means to believe in Christianity, the first block has to be creation. God is a creator, and that is where everything stems from. So there's a lot of debate, and there's been a lot of debate for the last 100 years or so about creationism and evolution and all this stuff, and the particulars of that debate I don't find all that interesting. But the issue of whether God created or not is incredibly important. And I don't know whether he created through evolution or through 6 days or 7 days or what forces, or whether the Big Bang is real or whether something else is real. That's just the details. But if you start to talk about, if you start to lose the idea that God created, then really everything falls apart after that. And what's really cool is when you start with this idea that Jesus created, not just God created, but Jesus Christ created, then it opens up a whole new layer of thinking about who Jesus is. Because if he really was involved in creation, if Jesus Christ, the man who walked the earth 2,000 years ago, was involved in creation, whenever it happened, however it happened, that says something completely different about who he is. You know, one of the questions current in our world is like, people say, maybe Jesus is one way to God and there are other ways to God, and maybe you can kind of have all these different paths. But if Jesus is the one that created, then that question becomes irrelevant, right? Because how could there be other ways? There's no other creators. Jesus is the way because he is the one who began everything. And so it's really interesting then that Paul starts with Jesus as creator. He goes on then to speak of Jesus as creator. And then the second thing he does is he speaks of Jesus as founding the church. So this is verses 18 through 20. Maybe somebody will read that while we're waiting for our slides to come back up. Does anybody have it in front of them? 18 through 20?
Sure.
Thanks, Andrew.
And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross.
Thank you. So there's a couple interesting things here that this hymn says about Christ. There's two really strong parallels with the transition that Paul makes here from Christ as being supreme over creation to Christ as being supreme over the church. He uses that same word, prototokos, in verse 18. He says, he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. And so whereas first he was the firstborn of all creation, now he is the firstborn from the dead. And so he's drawing this parallel between who Christ is in relation to the creation and who Christ is in relation to the church. And then he uses these same, remember those three prepositions? By him, through him, and for him. He uses those same three prepositions talking about Christ's relationship to the church. It's a little harder to tell because they're translated a little bit differently. But in verse 19, it says, "For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself." That "to himself" is actually the same Greek word as for him previously. So it's the same three ideas. And I think what is going on here is, it's like saying, Jesus created everything. That's what everybody knows. Everybody everywhere is familiar with the creation. You can't not know Earth, right? We live on it. We see it every day. But then he's saying, in the same way, Jesus created the church, this entity, this group of people, this people called out who follow Jesus and who form a unique community. And Jesus' relationship to the church is really similar to his relationship to creation as a whole. Do we have any readers? Who likes to read? I know Christine likes to read. Do we have like an author? What's your favorite author?
God.
Oh, come on. What's your favorite non-divine author? C.S. Lewis. Okay, let's say that C.S. Lewis were alive still. And let's say he wrote a new book. You'd read it, right? Because you form this relationship with an author and you say, I like the way this person does things. And if this person does something else, you buy it. Or same thing with musicians, right? You have a favorite band, they release a new album, and you're like, I don't know what the album's like, but I like this band, so I'm going to like this album. So you buy it. So it's like saying, I don't know what the church is like, but Jesus made this. He made the mountains and the oceans and the skies and everything. So if he made that, the church must be pretty cool too, right? It's the same author, it's the same creator, the same relationship. And what's interesting is that the creation's pretty beautiful, right? You agree? Pretty much everybody agrees with that, right? I mean, if you go around like downtown Palo Alto and you're like, man, isn't the earth ugly? People be like, huh? It's like this accepted fact that like the world we live in contains beauty. It's interesting that people just agree with that. And yet, if you went to downtown Palo Alto and you were like, man, churches are so ugly, or churches are so full of awful people, a lot of people go, yeah, they sure are, right? And yet, what this is saying is that the church, the collection of people gathered, and not PBC or some other church, but the church as the entity that crosses church boundaries and national boundaries and ethnic boundaries and generational boundaries and time boundaries, that's the church. The church is beautiful in the same way that the creation is beautiful. And in fact, you might even say that the church is more beautiful, that it radiates God's glory. So here's my picture of like something that is beautiful in creation, right? And yet if you think about church, I don't think about like church being beautiful. I mean, you sit next to some people, some of them are nice, some of them are annoying, some of them you know, some of them you don't. Some of them a little weird. You're not sure if you want to know them, right? I mean, like, church is like this mixture of stuff. And it's like, it is what it is, but it's not, like, glorious. And yet, that's what this passage is saying, is that Jesus is supreme over the church. And in that way, the church is more than we realize what it is. And so, If we start by recognizing Christ over creation, the next stage of this is to recognize Christ over the church. And what this does for us is I think it helps to recast what being a part of the church is. Because from the outside, it looks like something just like everything else in our world, right? I mean, if anybody on Meetup, if you don't know the website Meetup, you find like affinity groups, you do stuff. So there's a volleyball group online, and you go and you play volleyball. And there's like this, and maybe church is just like another group. You know, these are like the people that like Christ, and these are people that like volleyball, and these are people that go knit, and these are the people that go drinking, and these are people that do this, dancing, and like whatever, right? There's just like, church is just a place for people with similar interests hang out. That's what it looks like from the outside. And I think because we're so influenced by our culture, we can think that way. Oh, church is just the thing that Christians go do, right? Because other people do other stuff, so this is what we do. But that's not it at all. The church is something. The church is an entity. The church is like creation. God made it, and it's glorious, and it's beautiful, and it's complex. And there are parts of it that are ugly, and there are parts of it that are messed up, because even our creation, even the world, there's some ugly parts of the world, right? I've been in some of them. And yet, as a whole, it's beautiful. And so I think this helps to make us realize that this thing we're a part of, if we're part of this church, is way bigger than just a social club. It's bigger than a group of people. We're participating in something that is God's work and that Jesus created in the same way that he created the world. And yet, what is said about Christ is that he has made peace. And so what often isn't understood about the creation or about the church is that the creation itself is in rebellion to its creator. That little boy who sat down making a Lego world then finds out that this world has self-animated and tried to overthrow him, right? Has tried to fight against his powers and tried to say, no, we'll take it from here. Thanks, but no thanks. And what's interesting about that storyline is it's actually a fairly popular, common storyline, right? I mean, there's movies, the Man vs. Machine, I, Robot, every like year or 2 years, there's another movie where like machines come alive and they take over the world and there's an apocalypse and then Bruce Willis saves the day, right? I mean, that's like, we know this story. It's like, where do we come up with this? Why do we think this might happen? And maybe it's because this did happen. Like, somebody did create something, and that something rebelled against the creator and tried to throw off the creator's power. And so what Christ did is he called aside a certain amount of people from that creation and rebellion, and he made peace between the creator and that group. And that is who the church is. The church is those people who are back in a state of peace with the one who created them, who have thrown off, cast aside the rebellion that the rest of creation is enslaved to. So Christ has created the church. And then finally, in the last part of this, we hear about us. So verse 21 to 23, will somebody read this aloud?
And you who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. If indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister.
So here we finally get to what we're interested in. We get to us, right? We've been hearing about Christ in creation, we've been hearing about Christ in the church, and now the first words, and you. Now we're talking about our favorite subject. How does this relate to me? And what is said here is that we were participants in this rebellion. We were on the wrong side. We were alienated, hostile in mind. We were doing evil deeds. And what is said here of us is it's kind of like a time-lapse picture. So we see our past, we see our present, and we see our future. The past is that we were in a state of rebellion along with the rest of creation. We were hostile. We were engaged in evil deeds. That is true of each of us, even if we've known God from a very early age, because we're still aware of that part of us for which that is still true. That is still true in some ways of each of us now, that there are those things within us that are at war with God, that still want to throw off God's control, God's relationship. And so this is what used to characterize us. We were part of this creation in rebellion. And yet what has happened in the present, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death. So now we are those ones who have been transferred into a state of being at peace. We've been reconciled through his death, through what Christ has done on the cross. We are now brought back into relationship with that Creator. And the future hope then, the future state, is that we might be presented in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. This is a classic picture evocative of the wedding, right? The idea of being presented holy and blameless, pure. This is why brides wear white. This is why the moment that the bride walks down the altars where everybody stands up, this is the high point of the wedding, right? The bride has appeared perfect and pure. Her groom is waiting for her. This is why weddings are such powerful events. They tap into something that is really at the heart of our souls, this idea of being presented in glory, in beauty, being desired, being everything that we want to be. That's why brides wake up at 4 a.m. to start putting on their makeup and getting ready and doing their hair and getting dressed. And it's like this is that moment that you're representing what really lies at the future for the church, this state when we are presented to God clothed in white. And I think it's something we can't even imagine because we're so used to being dirty. We're so used to being less than we want to be. We're so used to not measuring up. We're so used to failing and beating ourselves up over it and being disappointed about the ways that we can't be who we want to be, that this just seems like a fairy tale. How could I ever be presented holy and blameless? And yet this is what's in our future. This is what God has done. This is what Christ does for us. He promises that this is where it all ends. This is where it leads. Acer is having so much fun tonight. And so, what do we do then? What's the application? Well, it says, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast. This does have some dependence on choices we make. But notice that it's not if you serve God with all your heart and become the best Christian you could possibly be, or if you lead 24 Bible studies and convert a bunch of people, or if you reach this level. It's simply if you keep going, if you continue in the faith. And this is what I really want us to get as we study Colossians. Christ is at the center of the world. He's at the center of the church. He's at the center of their lives, whether we realize it or not. And so it's not this like, oh my gosh, I gotta cram to understand all this deep stuff. I gotta beat myself up to live better and do better and attain some new heights. It's simply continue in the faith. Keep going. The image we saw last week was one of walking, and that's going to come up again next week, of just walking in faith, step by step. You just keep following this gospel that we know. Keep following the steps that have been put in front of us. Circumstances are going to be difficult. There will be all sorts of challenges to continuing. There will be pain. Some of you will see loved ones go through extremely difficult circumstances. Some of you might be seeing that right now. Some of you will be in relationships where you're betrayed. Some of you will experience great illness yourself. but you'll also see great joy. You'll have moments of victory where something you never thought could happen will happen in your life. Something you never thought you deserved will be given to you. Some accomplishment that seemed way out of reach is now attainable. And through all of those, the ups and downs, through all of that, it's just about continuing. Just step by step, walking through them. So, this hymn of Christ then reminds us that the whole world is about Christ. It's not just church. It's not just an event that happens every week or a Bible study, but everything, everywhere, in all time, has Jesus somewhere at its center. If you go back to my Psychology 101 class that had Zimbardo at its center, there's something about that that is inherently unattractive to us, right? I mean, you've probably been in relationships where it's all about the other person. You've talked to people that they are only interested in themselves. Maybe you've been in classes like my class where the professor is the center of the universe. And there's something we just don't like about that. You don't like being around people like that. They suck life from us. And maybe that's because there is somebody that should be at the center. Maybe that's because there is somebody who belongs at the center, that everything actually does revolve around. And when somebody else takes that role, there's something within us, even those that don't know Jesus, that realizes that they don't belong there. But perhaps somebody else does belong there. And that's what this passage points out, that Jesus does belong at the center, where everything is really about him. Christ created, Christ redeemed. He gave birth to the church. And this is the story that we're a part of. And so I said that a lot of gospel stories start with us and tell us what happened to us. But what this one does is it starts with the world, and it goes to the church, and then it says, this is what you can be a part of. It's not about you. You're not at the center of this story. You're not the main character. Sorry. But you can be included in it. You can be part of it. You can be drawn into it. And I think for all of us, we think we want to be the main character, but really it's a whole lot better to be included in a story like this.